Welcome to Radio Gorgeous, author of the week, Anne-Marie Neary, your book, The Orphans.
Hi, thanks very much for having me. Delighted
Absolutely.
To be here.
Absolutely. Could you give us the premise of The Orphans?
Okay, well, it's a book about obsession, really, at its core. And it's about family and about how two siblings react in very different ways to an original trauma, which is the disappearance of their parents when they were children playing on a Goa beach. Mm-hmm. And everything springs from that, really, in both their lives.
I was going to say, both of their lives are blighted and defined.
That's right, yeah.
By this.
Yeah.
They were equally blighted and defined. But I would say one is destroyed by it. And
yeah.
One,
yeah.
You know, sort of comes out of it. Can't reveal too much because it is also a psychological and a thriller.
Yeah,
it is a thriller.
Yeah, to some extent. Yeah. I mean, it's, I think the girl, orphan, the older of the two, Jess, she becomes a kind of a very conventional person. She contracts an unsuitable marriage. She goes for stability. I think she thinks that will save her. Mm-hmm. That, you know, the big house and the tall gate and the walls and her hard work, all that will save her. And, of course, it can't. And her brother, on the other hand, he devotes his life to looking for their lost mother. And he develops an obsession which spirals completely out of control and threatens everything that Jess has built.
Well, and he is wedded to being the victim of that story.
That's right, yes.
He's wedded to the story, he's wedded to being the victim,
yeah.
He is utterly committed to being the victim of that story, and he is like any other addict. He's kind of addicted to the story.
That's right.
And like any other addict, he needs that victim story.
Yeah, that's right, which is why he tells this story over and over again to women in bars, partly because he thinks one day he might find the missing link, but I don't think he really believes that. I think it's just that he wants something from women, and I think he wants, in particular, respect from them, so that when he doesn't get it, he's a very dangerous character indeed.
Well, because his story is being, and he expects to be left.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He expects to be left as his mother left him, because that's the person who's not supposed to leave you, and
she
did.
Yeah.
And so he expects to be left, but he tries to. And they're all the same woman.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they are all his mother.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, even to the point, there's a woman that we come to know a bit, and her name is Amanda, but she's like, nope, she's not Amanda to me.
You know, that's right.
She looks like Nefertiti.
Yeah.
So she's going to be
that's
Nefertiti.
Who she is. Yeah, exactly.
So it's his story.
He imposes his story on other people. Absolutely, 100%.
100% blind to everything else.
Yeah.
And his need to keep that story mm-hmm. going, because he's made so very many decisions based on that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And tell me, because that was very interesting that, you know, despite Jess thinking, oh, I'm not defined by this, she is very defined by it.
She has
gone for convention,
normality,
things that she can pin down. She works in contracts, so she literally pinned
That's
down
right.
every
Yeah.
detail.
She wants to be anything but her mother. Mm. I mean, her mother is the anti kind of role model.
Mm-hmm.
And she just doesn't want to know. I mean, she really doesn't want to know the end of the story.
Mm.
She's decided she can't afford to know the end of the story.
Another character in the book is the common.
Yes, absolutely.
Clapham Common, yes. Where you yourself live.
That's right.
And what I really liked about, because it really is a character in the book, and it is different things to each person in the book.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, funnily enough, we launched the book last week on Clapham Common, which was kind of a bit of an indulgence on my part, but it was really interesting to be there just beside the bandstand and, you know, look over to the right and one location is there, look over to the left and there's another. And I wanted the common to be it's his childhood terrain in a way, and it's a place of his imagination, which becomes very important in the book in a particular sense. It's the focus.
Who's William, but named Sparrow.
That's right. So it's a fantasy land and a land of, I suppose it's a place where the imagination can roam. It's a place without limits for him. And for her, her house backs onto the common, which in fact no house does on Clapham Common. So that's a little bit of artistic license there. I borrowed that house actually from Wandsworth Common, as it happens. So it's a bit of a mashup between commons. But the common for her is the place that she needs to shut out. And this gate is a bit of a feature in the book. Whether the gate is locked, who's going to come in through the gate, and at the party they have in the house to celebrate her rather errant husband's birthday, the gate is where her brother Sparrow returns. So, yeah.
And it is a place, as much as they can call home.
Yes.
It is a place that they have both returned to.
That's right, yes. Yeah. Because their aunt lived around there, and she was the person who took them in when the parents vanished. And although Sparrow was sent to school after a while, it was very much a kind of stable home place for Jess. Yeah, so they both returned there. I think because Sparrow suspects that that's where the mystery can be unlocked. And he's determined to unlock it in one way or another.
Yes.
Yeah.
And for both of them, which, you know, otherwise why would we have stories? For both of them, it is sort of a perfect storm.
Yeah.
Perfect storm of shite.
Yeah. Exactly.
Like, you know, it's sort of that moment in your life, like everything.
Yes.
Is, you know,
collapsing on top of you.
Collapsing on top of you. And there is born drama.
Yeah.
So, yeah. It is. You're sort of inexorably drawn into this, you just sort of, whirling storm.
Yeah. 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 Exactly. That's true.
Where did this story come from for you?
Well, funnily enough, and I was a bit wary about approaching her about this, but a friend of mine told me a story about, God, it must be 10 years ago, about someone she had heard of, she didn't know personally, to whom something like this had happened in her childhood. Now, in the way with writers, these things get stored away in your brain, and 10 years later it comes out on the page. And I tried to Google this story, but I suspect it might have occurred before, you know, internet was such a thing. I don't know, and I don't know if there's any truth in it or not, but it sparked off something in me. So I hedged around it a bit with her for a long time, and then I eventually decided I had to tell her. And she hardly remembered the story herself, which was bizarre, you know? Yeah. So I needn't have worried. And so I don't know if there is any truth in it, but that's where it started. And then one day, as you say, I live on Clapham Common, and I was walking along, and I saw a tall young guy, very pale, with a high-vis jacket, and he was just standing there with his hand slightly out to the side, looking at the school opposite. And the two things kind of merged, and that was my character.
Wow.
So in fact, there is a scene in the book where that occurs, actually, that little snapshot. So yeah,
which is
those two things.
I would say there's a lot of things that are very well observed.
In your
book, and that you just brought up one of them that. You know, because we are so highly visual,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we're making judgments all the time.
Yeah,
we're tracking, we're cataloging,
yeah.
100%. We're assessing danger,
yeah.
We're assessing situations all the time when we're not staring at our phones. But you know, and the use of a high, you know, the ways in which we make assumptions.
Yes, that's right.
And we make snap judgments and assumptions based on very little visual information.
That's right.
And many things could be hidden in plain sight.
Yeah, and you assume if someone's got a high-vis vest, they're meant to be there. In fact, there's a one of the Father Brown stories, Chesterton's stories, there is something about, I think it's a postman who comes into a room and he lifts a letter. And of course, he isn't the postman at all, but everybody just assumes he's dressed the right way. And, you know, so it's that kind of, you don't look twice. Whereas if the same person, you know, I don't know if he's wearing something completely different, then you would think, well, what is he doing there? Mm. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also I think we are trained, I say we.
Yeah.
As transplanted. We've drunk the British Kool-Aid.
Yeah, exactly.
And we are trained to not question as well.
Like yeah, no, that's true.
We're trained
true.
To give other people authority.
Quite compliant. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So like, all right, you're
Yeah.
You know, you're the one in the uniform. You've got the
supposed to be doing that.
Knowledge.
Yeah. That's so interesting. You're right there. Yeah, a bit worrying.
Yeah, exactly. Let's throw off that mantle and question
yeah,
everything.
Yeah, exactly.
And in that vein, I'm going to start questioning you
personally.
Oh, God.
Oh, no.
we're getting off the boat now.
I put the barriers on. Exactly.
Well, tell me about I want to lead you to your path to writing and your other books.
Okay.
As well as your short stories. But you like me, have had many different jobs.
Yeah.
Nay, careers.
Yeah.
So and amongst the cherry picking and the waitressing, etc. I want to touch on a couple of things. You were a civil servant.
That's right.
Dealing with cross-border smuggling.
Yeah.
And or peat bogs, as the occasion arose. Talk to me a bit about that.
Well, the peat bogs, I used to, believe it or not, there's an industry in Ireland which is, turf for burning. Mm-hmm. And actually,
a lot of people, you know, cook fires
and all that kind of thing. Yeah. So, you know, there was a big controversy a few years ago about what to do with these bogs once they're cut away and whether to plant them with this, that and the other. So I used to, one of the things I used to do was write speeches for the minister
responsibility for
peat bogs. Yeah. I can't remember much about it now. It's a very long time ago. But yeah, that was that. And the other was just dealing with cross-border smuggling cases. Those kind of things where someone has a tank on either side of the border, it straddles the border. And there's an input and an output point on both sides. And there's a form of diesel, red diesel, marked diesel, which is, you know, not taxed at the same rate. So obviously there was a great scam as to whether the diesel, you know, originated here or here. And, you know, the high-ace vans speeding across the border late at night, laden with this, that and the other. So, yeah, all of that. That was quite lots of stories there. So,
yes.
You know.
Well, and there will be more. You know what I mean? We're just creating.
Yeah.
We're in the midst of creating more more of that.
Exactly,
I remember
sadly.
Somebody talking about sort of in Ireland, like drunken borders, because they do meander.
They do.
And you can cross the border 8 times in a day
Exactly.
going around your business.
Yeah, that's right.
A bit ridiculous.
Yeah, but it's going to be very difficult to see how it's going to be resolved.
Yeah. We'll keep... Watch that space.
Yeah, watch that one.
Okay, you are obviously a very intelligent woman. And you seem to have a lot of different interests.
Yeah.
Okay. So one of them, Venetian art.
Mm, mm-hmm. Yeah, I did a master's in Venetian art a few years ago, and I had always been a bit obsessed with it, but I became totally obsessed with the place, really after that. And I haven't been now for over a year, but I'm going to go in October. See the end of the Biennale.
Yeah. It is a place that sort of infects you.
It does. It infects you completely. And the thing about the Biennale, which is great, is that a lot of exhibits are, apart from the main, you know, Arsenale and Giardini, in palazzos you wouldn't get access to normally. So, and that makes it very interesting. So, the city is opened up in different ways. Yeah.
For us to crawl and poke
around.
Yeah,
no, it's really fascinating. Yeah. But but there are problems, as you know, with the cruise ships and everything and the depopulation. And there's a lot of issues facing Venice at the moment.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And you also, like our Jess, have worked as a commercial lawyer.
I did, yeah. I worked in the oil industry for my sins at one point.
From diesel to oil.
I was working as an exploration lawyer. Mm. So... I did that for about 10 years. So I got to get around a bit, and yeah.
And what so what and then we come to writing. So
yeah,
I don't know what I'm getting at is what leads you to these things. What gives you the moxie to do it as well? You know, be like, all well, right, I'm gonna start that.
Or, no, I kind of wanted always to write, but I just wasn't doing it. You know, and then I gave up work, and then I was out for a while. Did the masters at that stage? Did various things. Went back, and I only went back for about a year and a half, and it was just I was too long out, really, way too long out. And at that stage, I decided, okay, well, it's now or never. You've got to do, you know, really do it and take this seriously. So you know, sit down and treat it like a job and make yourself do it. And I think it's like anything. If you turn up, it will happen. But you have to turn up, and you have to commit your mind to it. So yeah.
And why was that? And I ask as a person who has difficulty committing myself to my own writing, why was that difficult for you? Why was, I mean, because it doesn't seem like it was difficult. You're like, okay, I'll go to school again, and I'll do Venetian art, I'm going to do law, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. So but why was,
because I think going into that, I find editing very easy. I don't mind that. I find going into that cave, it's like a cave, and you're scraping things off the walls, and you're just trying to dig it all out. It's
only you.
It's really difficult, and you don't know whether you know whether it's complete crap or not. I mean, a lot of the time it probably is. And you, I found helpful. I have a writing group. So we still meet every Tuesday night. I don't always read now, but I nearly always turn up. And that's great just as a, you know, friendship group, apart from anything else. And, you know,
well,
you
and can... that seems to me that it also creates in your mind that, oh, I'm doing it for that, like I have to show up. With
well, yeah, that's yeah, true. It and,
sets
you know,
up, like, the expectation.
Yeah, so it's a bit
and
of a deadline.
For, exactly, and if you're doing it for other people, that's so much easier than doing it for yourself.
It's so much easier. Absolutely right. Yeah. And, you know, you turn up and you're on the tube going up there, and you realise suddenly that what you're about to read out is rubbish. You're there madly editing on the tube. But that's good because, you know, it's...
That forces
it's
you.
It's forcing you forward, yeah. And also you learn from other people, naturally, you know.
And where did you find your writing group?
Well, what I did was I did a course, years ago, but she's still doing them, in Central St. Martin's, a night course with Elise Van Morbida, who's a fantastic writer and a great teacher. And then she asked me to join her group, and we're still friends, and she's still, you know, in the group and writing, yeah, brilliantly. So that's how I found it. And then, you know, we've had people come and go over the years, and, you know, but somehow we keep it going.
Fantastic.
Yeah, it is. It's good.
And I assume you're working on...
Yeah, something. I am. Yeah, I'm working. I'm way, way from here now. Well, probably in Algiers. I don't want to say too much about it, but a lot of it is going to be based there, which is a fascinating city. It's got a huge history of turmoil and, you know, French colonialism and all of that, but it's an amazing place. So,
and do you have to do research and go?
Well, I've actually been a few times, and my son is going to come with me next month. We're off there, and because he's got fluent French, and even though Arabic is, you know, really the language now, French is still a lingua franca, so he can come and speak the language with me. And
And what is, okay, so you committed to writing.
Yeah.
And obviously you don't regret it.
Yeah, yeah.
What did it validate? Was it different than you thought it was going to be? Did it validate your hopes?
Yeah, I think the great thing about it is that nothing is ever wasted. So if you're bored at a bus stop and you see that funny woman with, you know, the earrings or whatever, you overhear a snatch of conversation.
She's looking at me and she says that.
You know, there's going to be somewhere that you can use that. So that's the great thing. That's the exciting thing. I mean, on the downside, it can be a little bit terrifying, you know, and you somebody gives you a horrible review and you think, oh my God, you've got to learn to be very thick-skinned and just, you know, realize that some people will like your book, other people won't. Other people won't. That's just the way of it. Yeah, I just, it's part of who I am now, and I can't imagine not doing it.
Fantastic. So. Thank you so much, Anne-Marie.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you very much, Donna.